We have R. Carlos Nakai, also known as RC, and Will Clifton. Live in Studio 2A. Here we go. Thank you.
91.3 KXCI, Real People, Real Radio. I am joined here, my name is Brooklyn, and I am here live in Studio 2A with Mr. R. Carlos Nakai and percussionist Will Klipman. Thanks so much for being here, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Just to give the listeners a little bit of a background here, in the span of his career, Mr. R. Carlos Nakai, whom we will refer to as RC for the rest of the interview,
right,
has recorded over 35 albums, including 8 Grammy nominations, 2 gold records, which is the first, I believe, and only Native American recording to earn that, I believe.
That's what we know.
Has sold over 4 million records. He's collaborated with musicians spanning a wide range of other cultures, including Japanese, Arabic, and Tibetan, just to name a few. He's worked with composer Philip Glass, and he's taken the flute to just uncharted musical territory in jazz and classical music. He's received acclaim from Billboard magazine to Los Angeles Times, among many others. And Will Klipman has also 5 Grammy nominations on his own, making the total between the two of them 13. Lucky number 13. Mm-hmm. Again, thank you so much for being here, guys. I'd like to go ahead and start things off. You guys have a new album out called Dancing Into Silence. And you have a performance on Saturday here in Tucson at the Vail Theater of Arts, which is not in Vail. It is here in Tucson for everybody listening. So why don't you go ahead and talk about the inception of that CD, the recording of it, some of the influences behind it, and just how it's different from the past recordings that you guys have done together.
Well, one big difference is that this album is 60 continuous minutes of music. There's actually no silence at all on the record, which is ironic since it's called Dancing Into Silence, but I guess it's a long dance to get there. Everything is cross-faded and interwoven, and that was the concept going in, but it took us about 3 days of recording to arrive at the threshold where we were ready to start making music in that way. So it was a really interesting process to work through our preconceptions of what music is and how songs are structured, and kind of let go of the idea that you have to be playing all the time to make it interesting. And we came up with the concept that we were going to try to make silence kind of the fourth member of the quartet, so to speak, and really allow silence and space to have a voice in the music. So that was a very new approach for us, and I think resulted in a really beautiful piece of work.
How did that become an inspiration? I mean, silence, how did you come to want to create an album that
well,
took that on?
Yeah, we hadn't done a recording in quite some time, and people were asking, are we going to do anything new? And I think we had reached a point in our collaborations where we were pretty much through with doing melodies and standard form. I guess I should say standard New Age form. And we had to sit down and kind of think about how we would approach this project. Robert Doyle came up with an idea of, why don't you just play? Don't put any structure into it, just play. And if there's any structure that will come into it, then keep it loose. Leave some space in the sounds that we would produce. So he was also very careful to not say melodies or rhythms or structures or progressions, but just do the sounds and let's see where they go. And that's what really took a lot of time for us to, you know, finally solidify somewhat. Because after years of playing and doing public events here and there, it's very easy to get back into the rhythmic structure of things, you know, and play melody lines and things that we were familiar with before. And then here's this new project. And for myself, I think it worked pretty well. You know, it's good for driving. And that's the way I listen to, you know, all the studio mixes that have been done, is jump in the car, put it on, and drive around in Tucson, fast, slow, get on the freeway, and speed around for a little bit and see if the music will hold together in all of that activity. And this one pretty much does. It'll last all the way to Flagstaff, so that's good.
Yeah. All the way to Flagstaff.
I tried it out in rush hour traffic in L.A., and it's great for that because it keeps you from doing stupid stuff. It doesn't put you to sleep, but it calms you down enough so that you're not subject to road rage.
Yeah. I think in when you listen to the project itself, it doesn't calm you, but it has a lot of interesting little twists and turns, little modes of expression, you know, that all of a sudden are changed. And, you know, having to do, again, inline formats, you know, it was like, gee, what do I do next? Let me listen. So building in the dancing into silence part was, I think, for all of us, also listening a little bit harder to what we were doing together, and then not just coming in, but making a statement that would sort of add to the, let's say, the colors on the palette of sound we were creating, you know.
I mean, so much of music is based on that, you know, melodic pattern. That melodic pattern. This kind of style of music, I mean, that must have just, you must be very much in the present when you're playing. I mean, how did that stretch you as a musician, you know, compared to what you had been doing?
Well, you really do have to be very much in the moment and kind of no mind. I refer to it as allowing ourselves to be the instruments and let the music come through in as undiluted a form as possible. And that's hard to do. I mean, as human beings, we want to make a statement and our egos sort of get involved and we want to display our technique and our mastery of our instruments, whatever they might be. So it was an interesting sort of act of self-effacement, sort of, to just show up and really be there and then get out of the way and let it happen.
Yeah.
And it, as RC pointed out, it involves a very high level of listening. I feel like you can almost hear us listening to each other when you listen to the record. There's a sense of really holding space for each other to let the music happen.
Almost like improv acting.
You listened to it four times in one day, so you probably have more to say about it than we do.
Well, it's like improv acting, you know, almost just really, mm-hmm. you know, playing off of each other.
Mm-hmm. Well, I kind of envision it as sort of haikus. You say a whole lot in a very short space of time, and it, of course, whoever interprets it, you know, that's up to them.
Right. Well, let's get back into some music. I think we'll play for another 15 or 20 minutes, and then we'll come back in and chat a little bit more.
Okay.
Again, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to 91.3 KXCI, Real People, Real Radio. We are live in Studio 2A with Mr. R. Carlos Nakai and Mr. Will Klipman, playing from their new album, Dancing Into Silence.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
91.3 KXCI Tucson, Real People, Real Radio. That was beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
I feel so. Well,
it's kind of strange just being in the room, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely makes a difference. I just feel so at peace.
Okay, good.
Our work here
I'm gonna
is
fall
done.
Asleep now, so you guys can just do the rest of the end. So RC, in your musical career, you've definitely explored a really impressive number of other cultural, you know, influences and musicians. You've worked with Japanese musicians, Arabic, Jewish, Tibetan, Hawaiian, American jazz, classical music. What was sort of the catalyst that prompted you to really take the native flute and expand it into some of these other musical realms?
Gee, big question. let me see. When I started in 1973, I had just come out of the service and was up home and had a friend who showed me an instrument that was more a wall hanger than it was a musical instrument. And I attempted to get it to work a little bit and found that I needed to create something else, you know, that was a little more amenable to being played. And in the meantime, I was talking to people here and there if they knew anything about the origins of the native flute. And there was very little information available, from tribal communities to individual members to ethnomusicologists, you know, in the Smithsonian and at numerous small museums here and there, you know, throughout the country. I was traveling at that time as a soloist and doing primarily, you know, solo traditional music and talking a little bit about the cultural traditions of American Indians. In all of that, I found that anyone can play the traditional stuff. And in fact, having spoken with other musicians that, yeah, we have this and we have that, but I'm always trying to push the envelope. What else can I do with this instrument? And I thought, well, I should be doing that with these instruments too. I found three flute makers that I continue to work with today, got them to see if they could create instruments that were close to the different minor tunings that you find in the Western European discipline of music that we all listen to today. And so got real close with that and then started on my side pushing the envelope by saying, what else can I do? Getting the basics down of how the music is structured and then writing new melodies and adding a little bit, you know, of the tradition to the new melodies so it wasn't entirely out of context, and say, well, these are my original compositions that build on the tradition. But I'll play a traditional song so you can see and hear the correlation between the two different performances, which are actually the same thing, but I just use another format of music to write in. And later on, you know, I remembered that when I was still in brass instruments.
You started off as a trumpet player,
yeah,
right?
Right. Yeah. I started, gosh, junior high school in Poston, Arizona, with a cornet that I thought needed to be a piece of plumbing rather than a musical instrument. But the man wouldn't relent and let me have the flute. You know, finally he just said, listen, men don't play flutes. And I said, okay, well, you know, I'll take this home and see what I can do with it. And 20 years later, of course, you know, I got in line with the military to go to all the military schools of music, plus Juilliard and, you know, down the line. And that never occurred. Came home, found the instruments, and applied all my discipline and training to the native flute, and I continue to do that today and write a lot more, compose pieces for small chamber ensemble and native flute and duets with other flutes or with other instruments of the orchestra. that seemed to work well together, and found even in that work that a lot of, you know, the what they call great masters of classical music had been doing it all along.
Right.
And they were also trying to break the rules and get the music out of the castles and the churches so normal people could hear what was being created.
Yeah.
And so that adventure, of course, led me to William Eaton and Will Clipman and what the Wild Boys are today, and then, you know, the RCNQ, the quartet of original jazz music that I put together with Amo Chip Dabney, who does his own work now here in town and has been doing it for quite some time, and Mary Redhouse and her brothers who do the Redhouse music, and thought, well, maybe this flute can do jazz too. And so we sat down and put together a number of pieces and some recordings, and now I'm almost entirely devoted to doing more classical pieces for native flute. I think it works very well in that genre, and so, you know, like with the recorder and other instruments, I think it'll do pretty well there.
Regarding these different influences, you both have quite a list of collaborations that you have. Is there any one collaboration in particular that just really was prolific to your own musical formation?
I think for mine, it was going up to a small place called Hollyhock Farm near British Columbia. It was out in the Channel Islands. And I met the person who began New Age music. And he lent me his delay system. And it had a 2.5 second delay on it. And I was amazed. This sounds like the Canyons. And so he said, I'll leave you with this equipment. Here's how you control it. You can be here all day, all night if you want to. You don't have to go to any of the classes, the music classes, and we'll see what happens. And, you know, and I fell in love with the effects units at that time.
Yeah.
So that was probably the beginning for me in meeting Paul Horn.
Great. How about you?
Well, yeah. I started playing when I was 3, so it's really been kind of a lifelong journey for me. My father was a semi-professional drummer, and so there was always a drum set and a piano in the basement of our house where I grew up in Philadelphia, and I was surrounded by music kind of in utero and from birth on, so yeah. It was a very early life experience for me, and as soon as I could get down the stairs and get up on the drum throne under my own steam, I did that. And I remember very distinctly hitting one of the tom-toms on my dad's old Radio King Slingerland drum set with the calfskin heads and the wooden rims. Something about that vibration just kind of rearranged my molecular structure. And I knew at the age of 3 that I was going to do this forever. And here I am all these years later still banging on stuff to get that vibration, you know, that feeling. But there's been so many wonderful collaborations along the way. Some very meaningful studies of mine were with master African drummers who taught me a lot about the folklore and the skin preparation and tuning the drums and carving the drums and lacing them and, you know, just all the physical aspect of, you know, going from an animal skin and a piece of wood to a musical instrument. So that was a huge influence on my understanding of percussion, and playing with some really wonderful musicians in all different genres, jazz and rock and funk and blues and R&B and reggae. And meeting RC was a huge turning point. That really completely altered the trajectory of my musical career and my understanding of my own instrument. Because the challenge then became, how do I play drums with a flute? How do I percuss in a way that's going to complement such a delicate vocal sound without overwhelming it? And that kind of pushed me in a very different direction, because I was playing a lot of really loud rock and roll and amplified music and breaking sticks every night. And
it's definitely quite a change.
Yeah, just guitar amps everywhere, and you know, pyrotechnics and lights and smoke machines and stuff, and then and to go from that to playing, you know, the ceramic udu drum all by itself with a flute. And I just fell in love with that. You know, I fell in love with the honesty of the sound, the naturalness of the sound. And you know, I've kind of been on that path for a while now, 15, 20 years, kind of pursuing that that aspect of what I do as a musician. So that's kind of the latest evolution for me.
Well, I apologize. We were going to have some pyrotechnics come in here tonight to perform with you, but they didn't make it, so
probably good.
Apologize for that.
We had everybody's hair on fire.
Well, why don't we go back into another set of music, another 10-15 minutes, then we'll come back and chat for a few more. You're tuned in to 91.3 KXCI, Real People, Real Radio. 91.3 KXCI, Real People, Real Radio. You are listening to a live in-studio performance from R. Carlos Nakai and Mr. Will Klippman. Earlier in the interview, RC, you mentioned being inspired slash influenced by the technology that sort of mimicked the sound of the canyons. And Will, you mentioned being influenced slash inspired by the process of how the percussion instruments were made with the animals. Just other than those things, or expanding on those things, how has nature been an influence in the music that you've made? Which I know is the most generic question ever.
Let me think.
Well, but what are some specific ways, yeah, I suppose?
I mean, I kind of think of us human beings as being nature. I think we make a mistake when we think that we're apart from it or separate from it or above it or in control of it. So the point of reconnection for me is sometimes when I'm doing something really, you know, sort of primal, like cleaning a skin. You know, I've got this skin tacked up on a board and I'm sort of cleaning it and just really, you know, very much face to face with this membrane that's later going to produce this musical vibration. And so, you know, I think it's all music. I mean, the wind, the birds, the thunder, the rustling of the leaves, a waterfall, you know, a stone dislodging from a canyon wall and bouncing down, and the echoes of that off the other rocks. It's all music. And it, you know, at some point you just sort of enter into that composition with your part, and try to integrate with that whatever space you're in. Even the space we're in right now, there's stone and there's wood and there's, you know, three human bodies, and so this is nature too. But that's kind of my take on it, is that, you know, we are nature and it's all music. It's happening all the time.
Yeah, and then, you know, the components of all these instruments, either the trees or the animals or, you know, grasses, and let me see, what else might there be? The soil, the basis for this planet, and all the minerals that are contained in the soil that start actually from volcanoes. So we've traveled and found the influences everywhere that I think what musicians do, regardless of their instrumentation, is they're the voice for the atmosphere that we live in. You know, the let's say the energy of all the living things around us, for all the influences, you know, that come from natural settings and from the activity of all the other living things, again, that surround us. We're quite fond of going to Hawaii and swimming in the ocean, either watching whales, if we're fortunate enough to be there nearby, and to feel the sound of their vocalizations in the water. Yeah. That's an entirely different thing. And I think that's kind of the influence that I'm trying to capture using electronics, to get the sound of the canyons and sometimes the sound of the whales in the water, speaking in their own voices about maybe being in that particular place at that particular point in time, you know. And then for me, of course, the whistles and flutes that we've used in the traditional sense are also the other kind of expression of our voice, our human voice, that we attempt to utilize when we're performing on the instruments. You know, many of the songs for me come from the vocal music tradition. But then I always have to think back and go, let me think about the first song I ever uttered. And the first song that young people always, everywhere on the planet, utter, you know. And it could be regarded as a shriek, it could be regarded as a as an irritating sound, but it's the first song that anyone has ever done. All the living things, I think, do it, and we attempt to retain that when we do our music. I remember one year we traveled to Hawaii and Will found a set of Hawaiian drums, some pahu, with shark skin heads, and he needed to have those. So we ran around with Mr. Makau, whom I met just last week, and he said, "Oh, I remember you guys. Yeah. That was exciting." It's such a small world. And yeah, it is. But the world of sound, too, is enormous. There's all kinds of stuff. And the drums came back to Arizona, and other drums that we've collected, in different places, and flutes that I've found from other cultures, they come back here. And I use them primarily to speak about how it is being in the world and having a good time. And also being, I think, aware of our responsibility as human beings to the way the planet will become in the future, and how what we play in the dreams of our music is also the expression of how we would like the earth to be tomorrow, because the past can never be changed, but it's always the future and the way we influence how that growth will be. I think that's our primary responsibility as musicians.
Yeah.
In fact, all musicians, I think, have that attitude.
Yeah. Sounds like I like how you both kind of touched on different things. You touched on mimicking, which is kind of honoring what the earth is already singing, I suppose, and then also harmonizing with it, sort of playing into what it's already doing.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. Well, is it possible to finish with like a short 2-minute song?
Sure, 2-minute burst.
Is that all right?
Speaking of nature, I'm going to go back to the sound of the earth itself, my udu, my clay udu drum.
Okay.
Kind of come full circle. And if I could just squeeze in a quick mention of our show this Saturday, April 24th at the Vail Theater of the Arts, a beautiful new 600-seat facility on the east side of Tucson. And we'll be there with our esteemed colleague William Eaton, who couldn't be here tonight, but he's a phenomenon in his own right. So when he adds his multi-stringed instruments to our sound, it gets pretty deep.
And if people want to find more information about the show, I think it's on your website, RC, as well as the. Do you have the website there?
Yeah, it's www.vtota.org/public events, where you can call 520-879-3925. That's Vail Theater of the Arts.
Or just look on our websites.
Yeah,
great.
That too.
Thanks so much again for being here, both of you. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you, Brooklyn. We're going to have to, next time we're in, we're going to have to find out about that nickname.
Again, you're tuned in to 91.3 KXCI Real People, Real Radio. We are listening to R. Carlos Nakai and Will Klippman. Thanks for tuning in. ¶¶